This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Huhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
we provide food assistance to some of the most vulnerable food insecure households. We've planned to reach about 1.2 million between now and end of September, and then scale up to about 1.8 million between October and December.
That's Eddie Rowe, director of the United Nations World Food Program in Zimbabwe, describing aid efforts to deal with drought. Details coming up.
Also, regarding Gabon's presidential election, French Prime Minister Manuel Valls says there should be a recount. And in Zimbabwe, the two-week police ban on protest in Harare has been postponed by a high court judge until a hearing tomorrow.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, French Prime Minister Manuel Valls says there should be a recount in Gabon's presidential election. He says the electoral process should be clear. Violence erupted in Libreville and in elsewhere last Wednesday after incumbent Ali Bongo was declared the winner. At least six deaths are reported and about 1,000 arrests have been made. Opposition challenger Jean Ping is refusing to accept defeat. He called the results fraudulent and said he is the rightful winner. Mr. Bongo had a winning margin of less than 2%. The French Prime Minister says a common sense would command a recount of the ballots, and he says he is concerned about the safety of the 15,000 French nationals in Gabon. Yesterday, Gabon's Justice Minister Serafin Mundunga resigned in protest over the election results and demanded a recount. Gabon's Constitutional Court is supposed to automatically review the results and decide whether to certify them. There's no date on when that might happen. Opposition leader Ping says he'll present evidence of vote rigging to the court. Meanwhile, the African Union will send a delegation to Gabon. Reuters quotes an AU spokesman as saying the political situation in Gabon is an urgent matter and that a high-level delegation will be dispatched very soon.
In Zimbabwe, a high court judge has postponed a hearing until tomorrow regarding a two-week police ban on protests in Harare. Opposition political parties filed an appeal after police announced the ban last Thursday. They said it violates their constitutional rights. The ban was announced one day before a planned demonstration in the capital. Police cited a manpower shortage for imposing the protest ban. They say they are not able to conduct crowd control for demonstrations. The court delay reportedly is to allow both sides more time to prepare their cases.
Over 80% of Zimbabweans live in rural areas and depend on food they grow themselves. But a severe drought due to an ocean climate pattern called El Nino is shifting rainfall patterns. Now millions of Zimbabweans are threatened with malnutrition and hunger. For the second part of our series on food security in Zimbabwe, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Eddie Rowe, director of the United Nations World Food Program in Zimbabwe. Rowe says there are several challenges that make the current food crisis so difficult.
The major factor, I would say, would be the issue of land and the infrastructure, particularly Zimbabwe being a mono-agricultural kind of system where 90% of the agricultural practice is dependent on rainfall. With lack of irrigation schemes and management of water bodies, the potential of agricultural production is not so high simply because access to water or the farmlands, people cannot exploit the full potential of the land. Definitely, the economic situation is also a factor. Remember, most of these smallholder farmers cannot afford to buy their seeds, their fertilizers, and even pay labor in their farmland. So it's a combination of these factors.
It must be a very challenging work that you do. What are you actually doing lately in terms of, you know, your actual activity at work?
Our plan comprises four components of assistance. The first is we provide food assistance to some of the most vulnerable food insecure households. We've planned to reach about 1.2 million between now and end of September, and then scale up to about 1.8 million between October and December. And January is regarded as the peak of the hunger season, and we are looking at targeting 2.2 million. But all of this is contingent on availability of resources. We also have the second approach, which is we work with communities to identify assets that would enhance their livelihoods or bolster their resilience to these types of shocks. Communities would engage in construction of community assets such as dams where, you know, they would be able to maintain water and help them rehabilitate some of the irrigation schemes and help them to develop nutritional gardens. The third approach is we are addressing moderate acute malnutrition, the fact that the nutritional situation is deteriorating rapidly among under fives. We provide highly nutritious products to every household that has an under five kid, as well as we have selected districts to address the incidence of stunting. And the final component is our emergency school feeding. We started receiving reports of a significant number of school kids either skipping school or dropping out of school simply because they would have to help a household to search for food, or they themselves would not have food for them to go to school. So these are the four components in our response plan, and hopefully we are seeing some generous interest from donors, even though we are a long way in terms of the resources required. The situation is not getting better. And I should point out another thing we are monitoring now. They are projecting a 60% chance of a La Nina starting from October. And that could lead to flash floodings, asset destruction. And we are hoping that the impact of La Nina would not be so tremendous. We are looking at a population from about 4 million that are already food insecure. This could easily escalate to about 6, 8 million. This would be the third consecutive year that the population of Zimbabwe has been hit by shocks on their food security and nutrition status.
That was Eddie Rowe of the UN's World Food Program in Zimbabwe. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
There are more than 700,000 economic migrants and political refugees in Libya. Many are West Africans who are looking for work. But about 100,000 migrants are being held in detention centers run by Libya's Interior Ministry in conditions one observer calls inhuman. Many others have been abducted by rogue militias and held for ransom. Otman Belbesi is the International Organization for Migration's chief of mission in Libya. From Tunis, he spoke to VOA's David Arnold about what happens when sub-Saharan Africans come to Libya without visas.
Many migrants are present in different parts of the country, and they work. Usually, they are daily workers working on daily jobs. But many times, there are raids, or sometimes the Ministry of Interior or the law enforcement officers just visit those areas and randomly detain some of the migrants. And when we talk about militias or people being stopped or detained by militias, I believe those are individual acts by certain militias for a number of reasons. But usually people should not be detained or should not be really targeted for their nationality or color of their skin or any other reason. But I can tell you that when you go to Tripoli, you see hundreds of migrants also on the street or looking for jobs, mainly in Tripoli.
Are there legitimate legal reasons for detaining these migrants and refugees?
We can talk about it from different perspectives, but according to us as an international organization for migration, people should not be detained only for irregular entry to a country. And this is the main reason why those migrants are detained, because they do not have a visa to Libya and they did not enter through the regular border. Unfortunately, we are talking about arbitrary detention without access to legal services.
Can you explain that a little more?
So you are detained for being either in the wrong place at the wrong time, so there is no process for detention. They collect migrants from the streets and drop them in detention centers. Or for those migrants rescued at sea, they are always sent to detention centers. The Libyan Coast Guard, their role ends once they bring people to the shore. They contact the Directorate for Combating Illegal Migration, who will be responsible for the migrants. And about the militia-run detention centers or gathering points, this changed from one day to another, because there are a lot of questions. Why would you detain people as a militia and pay at least for their food unless you really benefit from that? And definitely this will be part of a larger business.
Who are some of the militias that run detention centers of their own?
We are talking about groups who detain migrants and keep them locked in some place for some time, even asking for ransom or until the migrants call their families asking them to send money or even for forced labor. But for the names, unfortunately, I don't have names. We mainly focus on the humanitarian side.
What are the humanitarian issues that these migrants and refugees now face?
The ones inside detention centers, they face the poor living conditions inside the centers mainly, and some abuses from one time to another. The ones in the city, due to the current also political and security situation, many of them lost their jobs or were displaced from one place to another, which made it hard for them to find another job. And then the migrants usually fall behind.
And can you describe the conditions in some of these detention centers?
I can say in general the conditions in all of the detention centers in Libya are very poor and do not meet the minimum standards. Some centers are relatively better than the others, but still the situation where migrants are detained can be considered inhumane.
Do they receive food and water?
Yes, they do receive food and water, but sometimes there is interruption in the service of the food suppliers due to the delays in payments.
What is the question about payments? Who is paying for them?
The food suppliers have contracts with the Directorate for Combating Illegal Migration. Also, lately, we had a lot of meetings with this directorate advocating for, first, for the release of migrants and closure of those centers if possible, or at least improve the living conditions and provide better services to migrants.
Atman Belbesi is the International Organization for Migration's chief of mission in Libya. From Tunis, he spoke to VOA's David Arnold.
The mayor of Paris says two new camps for migrants will be opened soon in the city. They're expected to provide shelter for about 1,000 people. Mayor Anne Hidalgo says one of the new camps will be strictly for men and the other for women and children. The first is expected to open by mid-October. Reuters reports the announcement comes as French authorities once again consider dismantling the makeshift migrant camp in Calais called the Jungle. Many migrants there hope to find a way of reaching Britain. Truck drivers and business owners in Calais protested the presence of the camp yesterday by blocking roads. They demanded that a deadline be set for tearing down the jungle. To Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, and at 19 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Regarding Gabon's presidential election, French Prime Minister Manuel Valls says there should be a recount. In Zimbabwe, the two-week police ban on protests in Harare has been postponed by a high court judge until a hearing tomorrow. And two shelter camps for about 1,000 migrants soon will be open in Paris. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Public hospitals are coming under criticism because some patients are not being released until they pay their bills. From Bujumbura, Moses Havayarimana reports.
Burundi's hospitals are coping with a growing number of patients who cannot pay their bills. Prince Regent is one of the Burundi public hospitals that accommodate 600 patients. Dr. Christine Niyonsavie is the director of the hospital.
To control the situation of people who cannot clear their bill in the hospital, it's not always easy. Some governmental departments which take control of the situation, the hospital has to send the bill to that ministry, and it sometimes is very, very difficult for us to be paid even by the government. But we know that somewhere we are going to be paid.
Public servants and pregnant women in most cases have health insurance. This leaves a majority of Burundians uninsured. According to the director of the hospital, last year, six people left the hospital without paying their bills.
Sometimes we hesitate to take a person in the hospital because we don't know exactly how we are going to be paid for getting those person. But because of the identity of this hospital, many times we are obliged to receive them because we cannot let someone go out and die in the road on his way back.
Paying hospital bills is a challenge for some Burundians, like Nkunzimana Augustine, a 25-year-old student at the university in Burundi. He was diagnosed with bone tuberculosis, and he has not been allowed to leave the hospital for 4 months because he has not paid a bill worth about $600. He says the hospital did not provide good treatment because he could not pay for his medicine on a regular basis. Augustine says whoever is willing to help him can come on his rescue. He says until now he is still confined to the hospital as his fellow students have resumed their studies. Many people like Augustine have failed to pay their bills and have been held for 6 months until rescued by charities that bailed them out. The introduction of universal access to health care policy for children under 5 years and pregnant women has seen approximately 50% of the population in Burundi get access to health care. But they are among the few that don't have to pay. Some people, especially in rural areas, are not employed but still need medical care, even though they can't afford it. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Young Nigerian tech entrepreneurs are getting a little help from the government. Last week, 30 of them competed for the chance to pitch their ideas directly to President Muhammadu Buhari. Chika Oduwa has more from Abuja.
Nigeria has a growing technology scene full of ambitious young entrepreneurs. There is Angel Adelaja.
I'm the CEO and founder of Fresh Direct Nigeria, and we are creating uncommon farmers in urban spaces using container farming. We take a 20-foot container that you would put a car in to ship, and we kit it with hydroponic farming technology, and we farm vertically, and we're growing premium produce, vegetables, cabbage, lettuce, so many different things inside the containers.
There's Ife Dayo Oludapo.
I am the founder of Grid Systems, and what we make is a web-enabled multi-source energy monitoring device. It's kind of like a utility meter, but it measures power consumption from all the different power sources you have, which is a big deal in an under-electrified environment like Nigeria.
And there's Ima Okene, CEO of Trackology. He and his team created a barcode that will be posted on people's front gates so garbage men know whether a customer has paid for their trash to be picked up.
Once the utility provider comes to the house, all he has to do is just scan this barcode, and he knows in real time whether you've paid for that waste or whatever service he wants to offer you, and he renders it.
30 entrepreneurs competed last week for a chance to pitch their ideas to the Nigerian president. 3 were chosen to meet the president, and Ima Okene's Trackology was one of them. He won a cash prize of more than $8,000. The Nigerian economy slid into a recession last week for the first time in more than 20 years. The global slump in oil prices has left the government strapped for cash. That is why it is supporting tech businesses that might be able to spark economic growth. Last week's pitch event kicked off with a lot of fanfare. And when the biggest tech celebrity of all showed up, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, flashes from cell phone cameras lit up the room.
Thank you all for having me here today. It's awesome to be here with you. It's so inspiring to see what you've built here.
Zuckerberg was ending his first trip to Nigeria. He also listened to the winning pitches from the startup owners.
You know, this trip has really blown me away by the talent of the entrepreneurs and the developers in this country, and by the focus on building something that's going to make a difference and going to make a change. I think that if you keep doing this, you're not only going to shape Nigeria and all of Africa, but the whole world.
Lagos is currently the country's tech hub, but Abuja is developing its own tech scene with public workspaces and incubators to help young people who have business ideas. If the government's hopes are realized, one of Abuja's startups may blossom into the next Facebook. Chika Odua for VOA News in Abuja, Nigeria.
The UN's human rights chief says populist politicians like Dutch nationalist Geert Wilders and U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump are using fear to try to gain appeal. Zayed Rahad Al-Hussein says their reliance on half-truths and oversimplification is a communication tactic that Islamic State uses in its propaganda. He says the formula is simple: make nervous people feel terrible and then blame it on some group. Then offer a solution that amounts to fantasy, but would be a horrendous injustice to others. Zayed directed his comments at Wilders, who put out a manifesto that included a Dutch ban on immigrants from Muslim countries, the closing of mosques and Islamic schools, and outlawing the Quran.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, choosing the hero, my improbable journey, and the rise of Africa's first woman president. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize winner and president of Liberia, is a subject of a new book by River Levinson, an in-depth discussion on the life and career of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is next week, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.